to Juan F. Thompson, Hunter wasn't first and foremost a famous scribe who lived life to the fullest. He was dad. Juan F. Thompson has written a memoir called Stories I Tell Myself, Growing Up with Hunter S. Thompson, and he spoke to Anna Maria in January from Denver.
He became more vulnerable and very vulnerable with age after so much cocaine and booze, huh?
Yes, he certainly did. It took two forms. One was the cocaine use, and he really used cocaine as a kind of like you drank. It was a maintenance drug, you know, balanced the sedative effects of alcohol. I really think that that really took its toll over time on his ability to concentrate. It made it very difficult for him to write, you know, even a 1,000-word column, much less a, you know, a long article or a book.
I think Robin Williams was the one who said cocaine is God's way of telling you that you've got too much money.
I did coke with him.
You what?
Yes, I did coke with him.
No, you mean like Coca-Cola?
No.
Oh, come on, you're Phil Proctor.
He's,
you never did anything like that.
Well, it was only because he was hooked on the stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't want to embarrass him.
No,
I
said, it, right?
You know, I said, so I just went, oh, excuse me. I'm sorry, Robin. Oh, I got it all over your nose, didn't I?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, well, you just have to get that out there.
Cocaine is for horses, not for men. They tell me it will kill me, but they won't say when. Cocaine run around the brain.
And then the other part was the alcohol. And what was so interesting about it is that it's not that he became a sloppy drunk.
Phil did the my favorite character in the movie was the drunk French monkey.
Oh, in the Dr. Yeah. Doolittle series.
Dr. Doolittle,
yeah. I am the drunken French monkey. That's not I'm a social drinker. Sorry.
I don't even want to ask questions. I just want you guys to do voices for 2 hours.
Is that
that is just awesome. I just...
Could I have a little more of this water? Moo, that's good booze.
It was that the alcohol after... You know, he probably started drinking when he was like 14 or something. And by the time he's in his early 60s, the alcohol really, it's like a corrosive, and it just starts to dissolve the nerves and the organs and the brain, so that it became very difficult for him to walk. I mean, one of the things that was difficult to write about was the incontinence.
I sold out. So here's your last deal, Miss Presky. Now, which would you rather do? Hit this Jew over the head with a bag of sugar, or beat out that rhythm on a drum? Come on, love.
I'll take the bag.
You mean you're gonna trade this 4-foot cube of 18-karat Swiss bullion and the snake knives, Mrs. Presky, all for that little bag?
Oh, yes, I want the bag.
Well, all right then, open it up.
Yes. Oh, why? Why, this is a bag of shit.
But it's really great shit, Mrs. Presky.
And these are just the long-term effects of alcohol. And I am convinced, and not that he told me what he was planning to do or why, but I'm convinced that, you know, two of those major factors were his physical decline and his recognition that this was not reversible. There was no getting a new hip or a, you know, back surgery was not going to fix this, combined with his realization that he was not able to write. And for a man who was first and foremost a writer, I think that was just unbearable to him.
Did you ever get into bear baiting?
No, man, I never
went out. I could never get my socks off.
I went out with a few dogs once, man. I dated some dogs, but I never would go out with a bear, man. That's a terrifying thought, man.
Yeah, that's right.
I was into it for a while, their bear hating.
No, really?
Yeah, man, I hated those bears, man. I see a bear coming toward me, I just go the other way. That's how much I hated them.
They hate you too, man. You can't train them to do nothing, you know. They whist whenever they want. They cannot be trained. There's no way to control a bear.
They just squat, you know, anywhere.
That's why you got the expression, bear with you. I can bear with you. I can't bear that. All of those bearing expressions, man, that all bears on the same thing.
Owsley was known to his friends as Bear because of his prematurely hairy chest as a teenager.
In the labyrinth that American culture became in the 1960s and 70s, Hunter S. Thompson just might have been at the center. And in a way, that center still holds. Straddling the worlds of journalism and literature, politics and rock and roll, sports and film, Thompson found himself at the intersection of some interesting times. But interesting times are the oldest of curses, and mazes have monsters in them too. Eventually, the permanent address for the good doctor became Owl Farm at Woody Creek, Colorado, a literary salon and a firing range, and a home base for his family, his first wife Sandy and their son Juan.
By the time LSD became illegal in California on October 6, 1966, Owsley had become a mythic figure. He lived in a picturesque Berkeley cottage filled with high-end stereo equipment where he kept an owl to which he fed live mice.
In a faraway forest, there's a dark, deep well. Near the well, there is grass that is called Sleep Well. In the night to the well comes a big black owl, and he puts some grass into a big black bowl. And he pours in some water from the dark, deep well and prepares a drug with a nice, sweet smell. And he flies to the children and he gives them a drink. And they get very sleepy and begin to wink. If you ask me, my darling, you'll go to the owl and I'll tell it, Black Owlie, be a nice, kind fowl. Give me, please, for my baby, from your drug just a sip, and my baby will drink it and will sleep. Sleep, sleep,
sleep. But perhaps what Hunter Thompson liked to call the proud highway really started to open up for him when they ran him out of his own hometown. He was born in Louisville, Kentucky on July 18, 1937, the first son of Virginia Ray and Jack Robert Thompson, and was later joined by brothers Davison and Jim. The Athenaeum Literary Society gave Hunter his first readers, but he was already envisioning an audience on a much larger scale. So when officially invited to do so, he left Louisville at the age of 17 with a wild ambition, a fierce discipline, and the absolute conviction that he could write his way forward from there.
The core of the guy, you know, was when he'd say something and then you'd watch him laughing about it to himself and see the irony of his own words at times. And you know, and you could see, you know, a sweet kid from Kentucky.
There was this sort of, mutual kind of comprehension of what it means to hail from the dark and bloody ground, you know. And that was the term we used. We always called it the dark and bloody ground.
The war is over! The brutal industrial north has been defeated by the gentlemanly agricultural south!
Ah, see? Bet you didn't know the south won the Civil War. This is Daddy.
No true Mississippi cowherd would leave his wine cellar undefended in such a dangerous time.
Okay, we don't want this part in here. See, get up to
think
some
of the balls you'll have.
You're too young to think about that, Beulah Balls. Bells.
Okay. Now we gotta get to the part where they have this amazing vision.
Lost that war criminal.
This is more of the point. This is great.
Why, oh, Uncle Tom, you're back!
Uncle Field Marshal Thomas Lawbury Quadroon, honey, I'm back, and I'm beautiful.
I'm so glad that you're back, Tom.
It's good to have
you. See, there are many, many things that you don't know.
That's right,
everything
Tom,
you know is wrong.
I forgot. You're a free man now.
This is the best part of the play.
Oh, no, I ain't, General. Oz is pencil. As a professional state well, now, you've been wanting over this kinky old government for over 60 years. And now you plan to pay your puppet tax. Put it right here in the bag.
Bless for me. I die first.
your slave all the time. No more. Wigwam take turns. And guess who's joining in now?
Hunter, in his heart and at home and with his friends privately, was a supreme Southern gentleman.
Like Hunter Thompson, Owsley was also from Kentucky. His grandfather, also named Augustus Owsley Stanley, was a trust-busting Democratic congressman from Kentucky who spent 12 years in the House of Representatives. Elected governor in 1915, he became a United States senator and served on the commission that oversaw the construction of the St. Lawrence Seaway. Owsley adored his grandfather, but his relationship with his parents was difficult. Neither of them really wanted to be parents, he said. They had no skills for it. If you feel you can't love someone and you are universally told that you must love, you become very guilty.
We're such different people, and I grew up in such a different way than he did, a different time, a different kind of man. We just didn't know what to talk about or what to do. That lasted a long time, really into my 30s, when my wife and Deb Fuller sort of helped me to understand. He is communicating with you, it's just not in a way that you're expecting. And once I began to see that, it just changed everything. When I could see, we're up there for the weekend and it's time to go, and he, says, here, take this. And it's like a leather duck decoy. It's like, well, okay, thanks. You know, I'm thinking, why? Why is he giving me this leather duck? And, when I began to see that as it was an offering, it was his way of saying, I care about you and I love you. But he can't say it that way. He has to say it in this indirect way.
Hey, Joe, who won a second world war? You so smart.
After the aircraft carrier USS Lexington was blown out from under Owsley's father during the Battle of the Coral Sea in World War II, he began drinking heavily and became a lifelong alcoholic.
Your dad and mom were both heavy drinkers. You called them out on it at one point. Tell us how they responded.
I mean, I'm sure he knew he was an alcoholic, but he really didn't like being called out on it.
Who was that lady I saw you with last night?
Oh, that was no lady. That was Bottles.
Bottles?
I got so I'd drink anything. After that, I just couldn't seem to get off this stuff. My whole career went up in smoke.
And my mom, she reacted much differently. She ended up stopping drinking for a long time and now drinks very infrequently. But Hunter, he never acknowledged to me he was an alcoholic. At some point, I just accepted that this was who he was. And if I wanted a relationship with him, I just had to start from that point of, all right, he drinks a lot. He will always drink a lot. He does these drugs, he gets angry, and that's who he is, and there's nothing I can do to change it. So now how can I accept that and try to connect with him?
That was when you were like in your late teens, early 20s by then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when you were a kid, Juan, your parents were both drinking, they were both doing drugs. Just give us an idea of what kind of stuff was going on in the house when you were a kid.
Well, so first, just to put in context, I mean, this was the, the 70s. It was Aspen, and there was just a lot of partying by everyone. It wasn't just my parents. But so, I don't know, a typical evening would, include, lots of booze, of course. Cocaine was flowing freely. Hunter was a fan of mescaline. I think Quaaludes were pretty popular at the time. Maybe some acid, LSD. And so at a party, all of those substances were being consumed by, some group of everybody there. But to me, I mean, I was a kid. I didn't really know any better. I just saw these are adults. They're acting kind of strange. I tended to just, avoid them, go to my room and read.
A friend of mine gave me a sugar cube with a spot on it. He said, this is acid. This is LSD. They call it acid. I said, oh, yeah? What's that? He said, well, it's sort of like Morning Glory Seeds, only better.
Howdy, Dr. Tim.
I just thought I'd drop out and say hello. Hello.
Come back, Dr. Tim. We want to talk to you.
Oh, welcome to the Link of Spirited Guhuri, LSG. Wait a minute. Oh, well, another day, another green, blue, electric, yellow dollar. Got anything to drink? Anything at all?
And why is it that you're drinking, Timmy, me boy?
Because it's bad for my hullabaloosins. I get a chance to see things in real black and white. I despise electric pink.
You know, Dr. Tim is keeper of the sacred tablets.
Yeah, have a tablet. Oh, nice, paisley, horsey. Give the nice horsey some sugar cubes.
I'd come to Los Angeles itself in June via San Francisco, San Francisco via Cleveland, Cleveland via New York, and New York via Europe. So I left Europe at the very end of 1965, being in that colloquium of writers and movie makers and avant-garde sound people in Germany, and came to New York, where indeed there was a lot happening, man. I mean, it was the Fugs, and it was the Velvet Underground, and Andy Warhol, and there was a lot going on. I was not invited, by the way, I have to tell you. I was not invited to the Truman Capote Black
You didn't go to that.
No, and I wasn't tripping either. I'd taken my acid in Berlin when it was legal, when we used to get it from Sandoz in little legal bottles, and nobody knew what it was. I told you that story about my first small trip going down to see, to meet Kenneth Anger and see his marvelously, homoerotic films in the CIA secret viewing room on 25 micrograms of Sandoz. And I went, this is it. I don't like this stuff. I'm not even sure I like Kenneth Anger.
You write about your father's violent temper. When would that come out?
You never knew just when it would come out. And that's part of what made it so scary. It could be something completely trivial. He couldn't find the salt, and he might, go into a rage and start yelling and maybe throw something. At the same time, something that I would expect to make him furious, like I write in the book about the incident with the shotgun, and I went out to, shoot some birds, and I expected him to be in a complete rage, and he was quite calm and fair. So what made it especially unnerving was its unpredictability.
Because sometimes he would just shut down on you because of anger, and other times he would yell.
Mostly yell. That was he was not one to withhold his feelings.
Well, he would threaten to give you a beating, and you make the point that he was such a wordsmith that he chose the word beating on purpose. What effect did that word have?
Well, it's a scary word. Has this connotation of great power and force and pain. And I am sure that he chose that very deliberately. And as I say, he never actually hit me. I think his goal was to make sure I was scared so that I wouldn't do whatever it was he didn't want me to do. And it worked. I mean, he was also just a big man. He was like 6'3", 6'4", very physical presence. To a small boy, a man like that yelling was scary.
In fact, you call him a bastard a number of times in the book. Do you think Yes. He knew or cared how you felt about him at that time?
I think he was aware that what he was doing was harmful, and a question that I've never really been able to resolve for myself is how much control did he have? I think when he, lost his temper and said hurtful things, he probably felt ashamed of it later. But he was either unable or unwilling to stop himself, and he wasn't very good at apologizing.
So I went from there. Oh, my God. So then I ended up in New York, right? And all that stuff going on, I'd already been with a Living Theater, not a member, but close to them. And go via Cleveland to help my dad open his men's store, and on off to San Francisco, which was supposed to be, you know, it was hippie haven, okay? Hey, welcome to San Francisco. I thought I was going out there to sleep with an old girlfriend. Turns out I arrive at her apartment, and she's hooked up with Neil Cassidy. So I don't have no chance against Neil Cassidy. I guess he's pretty famous, man. So they were all very sweet to me, and they gave me this apartment on Polk Street. And I look out one morning, and there's Timothy Leary and Allen Ginsberg walking into this acid symposium. I don't think it was called that, but that's what it was. You could see just through the door all of these, you know, crazy squiggly, squishy things being projected up on screens. Remember those days?
Oh, yeah.
And I watched those people go through, and I said, man, this is so juvenile. Those people are so completely not getting it. I know this is what hit me.
Well, at one point, your parents are separated, and your mom introduces you to acid. You're 14 years old. What happened?
I would never, it just wouldn't even occur to me to introduce my son to you know, LSD at age 14 or at all, for that matter. But part of it was definitely the time. On one hand, I think, well, you know, did it do any harm? No. But was it a lapse in parental judgment? Yeah, I think so. An odd side effect of it is that by the time I was, you know, like 16 or 17, I was like through my experimentation phase, you know, don't care for that stuff, don't care for that. You know, not being into drinking. So, you know, by the time I started college, it was like, I'm done with all that stuff. I'm here to study. I'm not here to party.
Yeah, when you became the rebel the other way. Yeah,
exactly.
But that first experience, your mom was with a boyfriend, and it was almost a ceremonial thing, the taking of LSD. It was your trip master?
Yes. It sounds so bizarre to hear you say that.
I'm just quoting you, yeah.
you know, hear someone else say it, it's like, well, that is just crazy. But yeah, in retrospect, I mean, especially hear someone else say, yeah, your mom was your trip master. It's like, wow, that is just not right.
and it was the 70s, but this is 2016. Tell us what a trip master is.
Basically, the responsible adult who was, you know, not on drugs. In an odd way, she was being a responsible parent.
What's happening? Exactly, Eddie. But don't you worry, because all the hallucinogens used on this show have been prepared by and under the constant scrutiny and supervision of the Armenian Medical Association. Boys, give him the sacrament. Bring him up here now. He's just like a baby. There you go. That beautiful?
I don't feel a thing.
He doesn't feel a thing right now, ladies and gentlemen, but he will, and when he does, oh, is he going to be surprised?
It's awfully hot in here.
Cold. Really cold.
Have you got anything to eat?
I'd like an orange.
You know, or the sun.
Well, not. The rules of our little game, Arnie, are very simple. All you have is from now until the end of the show to realize your true self and to discover the key to the universe. Well, I see that our contestant is already accelerating. I'm sure that he's already in contact with his gene pool and that the three-ring retinal circus is flashing before his eyes. Let's find out how he feels in his race against the clock for enlightenment. How is it, Georgie?
He's
knocking at the door of the first Bardo. Will he make it? Will it happen?
So I never got into that space that a lot of people get into where they say, oh, it's the drug that's doing this. This is a hallucination. This is a non-real effect which is being produced by a chemical which is in my brain. I had to deal with it as though this was the absolute concrete everyday reality. Now, deal with it, right? And that was interesting because that's different. It's different that way. See, mm-hmm. you do a whole different, you have a whole different set, right? It's like the difference between sitting in a, driving a car in a video game, or getting in a car, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she wouldn't let me drive the video game car.
She made me deal with it.
Deal with it, on the street, now. And so when I got to this point in the acid test, when I saw sound coming out of the speakers, I was totally programmed to accept whatever I saw as being real, more real perhaps than my everyday life, which I had come to believe was restricted consciousness.
I'd like to see a positive LSD story. Would that be newsworthy? Just once? Today, a young man on acid realized that all matter is merely energy condensed to a slower vibration, that we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. There's no such thing as death. Life is only a dream, and you're the imagination of yourselves. Here's Tom with the weather. What a fucking story.
Owsley did not parachute into the human being in January 1967, as was widely reported, but he did provide 300,000 hits of acid called white lightning for the event.
White lightning, this is ground beef control. Do you read me? Over.
I read only good books. Over.
You must be way out there, Pastor. Over.
I'm high, all right.
5 months later, at Monterey Pop, Owsley passed out his Monterey Purple backstage to Jimi Hendrix, Pete Townsend, and the Stones' Brian Jones, not to mention much of the festival staff and crew. Owsley also sent a photographer back to England with a telephoto lens packed with tabs of purple acid on the condition that he share them with the Beatles. The thing about Owsley, Townsend said, is that when he gave you something, he would take it too, just to show you. He must have had the most extraordinary liver.
Okay, one of the big sounds that you heard right here. Wonderful wino time, ping pong, 5 minutes past the big hour of 5 o'clock. And say, stick around following the show, kids. We'll be featuring some local basketball. Today, Andy Granatelli Vocational plays the Mighty Purple of Owsley High. One of the big games, too.
Then, I saw what looked like the quintessential hitchhiker. His red, white, and blue fringed jacket was flapping in the wind. Want a ride?
Hey, psychedelic, man. I'm heading up north. I got tickets for the Janis Joplin Big Brother and the Holding Company concert.
Janis Joplin? She's dead.
She's dead?
Where have you been?
Oh, I can't really say, man. I dropped some Purple Owsley before the Great Society concert in Golden Gate Park. And the last thing I remember was a Hell's Angel kicking me in the head.
Man, you've been out for 8 years.
8 years? I thought my hair would be longer than this. I guess my Jimi Hendrix tickets are no good either, huh?
I'll say he's dead, too.
Jimmy, dead! Ah!
Jim Morrison, too.
Oh, no! Jim Morrison!
And Jim Croce.
Jim Croce? Who's Jim Croce? Tell me, man, is Paul McCartney still dead?
No, he's alive again. But the Beatles broke up.
The Beatles broke up? Oh, no! Far out, man!
I could see that this modern-day Rip Van Ripple wasn't ready for all the staggering Nixon news. So I invited him to come along to the Dead concert.
Grateful Dead? Oh, sure, man. I love Pigpen.
Pigpen's dead.
Oh, no! Pigpen? Bummer!
Hunter liked to keep in close touch and just out of reach. Woody Creek became the center for the maze. For Hunter, the world might be getting a little less interesting all the time. But it was more interested in him than ever. And there was always the business of having to be Hunter S. Thompson, a real man inside a booming franchise, the same concerned owner and operator for lo these many years.
There was a Rabelaisian touch in Hunter Thompson.
A drug person can learn to cope with things like seeing their dead grandmother crawling up their leg with a knife in her teeth. But nobody should be asked to handle this trip.
His was a life of excess. And you name the area, and he was excessive in the way he participated in that area.
How long had I been lying there? All these signs of violence. What had happened?
Anybody who could consume as much as he did is AO ipso phenomenal.
There was evidence in this room of excessive consumption of almost every type of drug known to civilized man since 1544 AD.
The day always started for Hunter, usually in the afternoon, which started breakfast.
It's a sad state of affairs when this reporter has to go heavily armed to breakfast.
And what a breakfast it is. Still alive, still kicking.
Six half grapefruits, you know, four Bloody Marys, you know, a couple of tequilas, pack of cigarettes, and, you know, two pitchers of coffee.
Could I have another round, please?
Of cocktails.
Everything. Cocktails, food, you know, Super Sunday. You got to store up as much energy as you can, a day like this.
I start with Chivas and water on the rocks, orange juice, grapefruit juice, coffee. That was it. That was a beautiful spread for him.
He'd order three or four entrees and eat one of them and maybe eat half of another and say, you know, can you box those up and I'll take them home.
And that would be in the side, his what he had for every day for years. Fruit, it's all fresh fruit, berries, apples, bananas, covered with a layer of Jell-O and gin.
It was not unusual for him to order most of the things on the menu.
Two more club sandwiches. One, two, three, four shrimp cocktails. And nine fresh grapes.
He ordered four margaritas and six bottles of beer.
I think if he had actually consumed all the stuff he claimed to consume and done the things he did, he would have killed himself when he was in his 20s.
Yeah, I'm an addict. I have an addictive personality.
And this waitress kind of looked nervously and giggled a little. And she said, sir, are you expecting some other people? I can get you a larger table. He says, well, I don't want a larger table. I want six beers and four margaritas. You speak English?
Ultimately, of course, Hunter Thompson couldn't satisfy his appetite such as there was for life.
But what the hell? You can't win them all.
Most people are surprised that I walk on two legs. And the idea that I would have a wife or a child, or I think I said this, even a mother, that seems to surprise me. I think people think I'm very much maybe a violent version of that comic strip.
Comic strip people are supposed to stay on the paper or the screen. Any reader of Doonesbury has a legitimate expectation that Mike or Jeff or BD or Zonker or Joni knows his or her place and will adhere to it. It goes without saying that if any one of them might break the rules, it would be Uncle Duke. A character with his jump-the-shark personality would be the one to bust out of his two-dimensional confines to call me on the telephone one night. The call came during an Uncle Duke episode in the strip. The caller was Hunter S. Thompson, who through a long Drug-O Gonzo career was unable to separate himself from fictional characters, his own and others. Uncle Duke was in no mood for conversation. He was calling to have me deliver a message to Garibaldi, my moniker for Uncle Duke's creator. I was to tell Garibaldi that Duke was onto him and he was prepared to take steps to stop him. The ultimatum was outlandish enough to convince me that it surely was Uncle Duke, a.k.a. Raoul Duke, a.k.a. Hunter S. Thompson himself, at the other end of the line. Worried lest Uncle Duke, with his love of firearms, turn up at my door, I offered to give him Garibaldi's telephone number. No, he said, he wasn't going to let Garibaldi trap him through a phone. I asked something to the effect of, what in Sam Hill are you talking about, Uncle Duke? Duke answered that Garibaldi had surrounded him with spies and informers who had infiltrated his home and violated his family's privacy. He said that every domestic secret, everything that took place between him and his wife Sandy, was being relayed to Garibaldi, who was putting it all in a strip. The gist of Uncle Duke's paranoia was relayed to Garibaldi, who made a noise I could not interpret. Uncle Duke, I repeated, says that you know the intimate details of his life that you could only have learned by spying on him. Garibaldi explained that he obtained the intimate details of Hunter Thompson's private life by reading his books and articles. True facts, I asked, that anyone can get by going to a public library? Yes. When Duke was told that he himself was the source, he called me a liar, mumbled, and hung up. I told Garibaldi that accuracy had no place in Doonesbury. He didn't exactly say amen to that, though he agreed that, while sticking to the truth might make you free, it can also get you into tight situations.
Greetings, lads!
What's with the threads, Ted?
Well, I'm in disguise, guys. Running around with a suitcase full of guns and drugs, a dude can't be too careful.
That makes sense. What do you want with Canada, man?
Yeah, what's with the gun, son?
I hear old Gary Trudeau's holed up in Ottawa. I'm gonna plug his ass for all this Uncle Duke shit. I ain't nobody's uncle.
Hey, what's your name, James? You're giving off some very familiar vibes.
Name's Thompson.
Ah, the cat who owns all the newspapers. I don't think we want to let in any capitalist riffraff.
All newspapers? Not fucking likely. I help sell a lot of Rolling Stones, but Jan'll never give me a piece of the action. I shall take a piece to that piece of shit.
Let me know. You are with the Rolling Stones.
Well, I might have given Mick an idea or two along the way.
Lay a cool, cool hand on my head. Ah, come on, Sister Morphine. You better make her my bed. She knows, and I know, in the morning I'll be dead.
Hey, you sure got a lot of stories, man. You trained to lay a number on us?
Who, me, man? Nah. Here, have a number.
Hey, Acapulco, Agua Marina. All right, come on in.
What a crazy cat. Probably related to Simrel. Let's have a token.
Bear told Rolling Stone, I'm not really interested in talking about myself. I don't want my life exposed publicly. I'm interested in the work I've done and the things I've discovered and in some of my philosophical stuff because I think it's of value. But I'm not into being a celebrity because I think celebrityhood has no value to anyone, least of all to the celebrity. I've watched wonderful people get destroyed by it. Augustus Owsley Stanley was killed in a car accident in Australia in 2011 at the age of 76. Now largely forgotten, except for being the star of the Steely Dan tune, Kid Charlemagne.
While the music played, you walked by candlelight. Those San Francisco nights were the best in town. Chance you crossed the diamond with the pearl, you turned it on the world. That's when you turn the world around.
Did you feel like Jesus?
Did you realize that you were a champion in their eyes? On the hill, the stuff was laced with kerosene, but yours was kitchen clean. Everyone stopped to stare at your Technicolor motorhome. Every apron had your number on the wall. You must have had it all. You go to LA on a dare and you go it alone.
Could you live forever?
Could you see the day
Thompson never acted his age his whole life. He was born old, and he remains forever young. Buy the ticket, he once counseled. Take the ride. But the ticket costs more all the time, and the ride gets a little slower, a little shorter every year.
The world is like a ride at an amusement park, and when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud, and it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride, and we kill those people.
Shut him up. We have a lot invested in this ride. Shut him up. Look at my furrows of worry. Look at my big bank account and my family. This has to be real.
It's just a ride. But we always kill those good guys who try and tell us that. You ever notice that? And let the demons run amok. But it doesn't matter because it's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
She don't.